Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. The hole is bigger than ever. Scientific calculations over Antarctica have measured the biggest ozone hole ever seen. What's causing it this time, and what does it mean? We'll talk with a NASA scientist. And gardening, it's not over till you tuck it in for winter. And Jack Ward Thomas, new head of the U.S. Forest Service, indicates his philosophy.
As Aldo Leopold said, the first rule of intelligent tinkering is to save every cog and wheel, doing the best we can to preserve those cogs and wheels and the integrity of the system.
These stories this time on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, 1-800-CARHERE, and the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York, and this is Bruce Robertson. Paul Newman is an atmospheric physicist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Using satellite sensors, Newman and his colleagues this fall found some startling news about the ozone hole over Antarctica.
First of all, you know, the ozone hole is a large depletion of ozone centered generally over Antarctica. And it covers a fairly broad region, upward of 20 million square kilometers. Now, to give you an idea of that area coverage, the United States, the lower 48 states, have an area coverage of about 8 million square kilometers. So we're talking something, a loss of ozone that's about 2.5 to 3 times larger than the United States in area coverage. So it begins to occur in August, and then the ozone begins to decrease over Antarctica, and it finally reaches its lowest levels in early October, and then ozone levels begin to recover to their more normal levels. If you go back into the 50s and the early 60s, you used to see levels of ozone that were around 300 Dobson units, and a Dobson unit is simply a measure of how much ozone there is overhead. So we used to get measurements of about 300 Dobson units. This year over Antarctica, we saw the lowest ozone levels that we have ever seen anywhere on the planet. We saw 88 Dobson units over the South Pole on October 6th of this year. So the ozone hole was extremely deep this year, about a 60 or 70% loss of all the ozone over Antarctica.
Of course, we want to talk a little bit more about the how and the why of that, but I'm wondering, do scientific world know what causes this hole, whether it's large or small in general? What is the cause of this loss?
Well, we made measurements in 1987. We took a spy plane, a modified U-2 plane that could get to high altitudes. It can fly into the stratosphere over Antarctica. We took it down to Antarctica in August and September and October of 1987. We flew it over Antarctica and found that there were incredibly high levels of a molecule called chlorine monoxide. And chlorine monoxide can directly destroy ozone. The reaction of ClO with ozone, ClO is chlorine monoxide, can destroy ozone. Now, so then the question came up of how do we get so much chlorine over Antarctica? Well, the bottom line to that is that we use chlorofluorocarbons down on the surface here. They go into our refrigerators and other things. Those chlorofluorocarbons can only be destroyed by very intense ultraviolet radiation up in the stratosphere, and they break down into their component parts. The CFC molecule breaks down, and one of those parts is chlorine. That chlorine then, as it gets moved around in the stratosphere over Antarctica during the late winter in the southern hemisphere, can be released into this chlorine monoxide, and then that chlorine monoxide destroys ozone. So the bottom line is, it's chlorofluorocarbons that are produced, that are man-made. The chlorine over Antarctica can destroy a lot of ozone.
I was anticipating your saying that was the culprit, the smoking gun, as it were, because what I had in mind was right around the time when this was first discovered, the very famous and highly effective Montreal Protocol, the international gathering of nations reached an agreement, a long-term plan as to how to mitigate this problem and reduce and eliminate our international worldwide use of chlorofluorocarbons. And to some extent, that has kicked in on schedule. And as a matter of fact, we understand some manufacturers have even stepped up their timetable to cease the production and use altogether. And if that is so, why is this hole still appearing? And even more so, why is it bigger than it ever was if we are using less and less of these chlorofluorocarbons?
Well, that's a good question. The chlorofluorocarbons, the reason that they're so widely used is it's a very benign gas. That is, if you inhale a chlorofluorocarbon, it has no effect on you. And so it's very difficult to destroy a chlorofluorocarbon, a chlorofluorocarbon molecule. The only way it can be destroyed is if it gets way up into the stratosphere and is destroyed by the intense ultraviolet radiation of the sun. Okay, that's where it gets broken apart. Now, that time scale to break up that chlorofluorocarbon molecule is very long. It takes a long time for that CFC to leak out of a refrigerator or be released here at the surface and then get all the way up 30, 40, 50 kilometers above us. It's basically got to be moved up into the stratosphere down in the tropics, and then it gets mixed down over Antarctica. And that time scale is on the order of decades. And so the CFCs that we released over the last 20 years, and even today as we continue to release them, those molecules are going to take a long time to have an effect over Antarctica. It's going to take decades for them to get down to Antarctica, and then they can do their destructive process. The chlorofluorocarbons in the stratosphere are going to continue to increase for about the next 10 years or so. Maybe around the year 2000 is when they'll begin to fall off in the stratosphere. And they'll can fall off at a relatively slow rate because it takes a long time to destroy all of these CFCs that we've released. So we're going to have an ozone hole around into the next century, possibly out to the middle of the next century.
So tell us again then, typically you said the size of this hole on any given year is about twice the size of the United States, or is that the size that you found this year?
It now, if you go back to the early 80s, it was actually, you know, the size of the ozone hole was about the same size as the United States. It's been increasing with time every year. Last year, it peaked out at about 23 million square kilometers, which is about three times the size of the United States. This year, it got up to about the same size. The hole was a lot deeper, but it was also a lot more persistent than it was last year. That is, last year, it kind of, you can compare it to a particular winter where you have one really cold day. That would be equivalent to last year. This year, we didn't get quite as cold, or we didn't get quite as big a hole, but the hole was big for a large number of days. And so if you do an average, you find that this year was the largest hole. But you do have to do an average to get that result.
Newman says another property of this ozone hole is that it will stay over the southern hemisphere, affecting people living in the southern hemisphere. He notes that there has been some ozone loss noted also over the North Pole. The largest, however, is concentrated over Antarctica. Though its effects on birds, fish, and ocean life in that region are being studied, Newman says we are not likely to see or feel any direct effect in the north, except that over time, the hole will fill in with ozone molecules from elsewhere around the planet, resulting in a thinning overall, robbing Peter to pay Paul. The good news out of all this, he says, the scientific community is now united in agreement that chlorofluorocarbons are the cause and that we must and are ceasing their use. And he says, though, it purely is a matter of time. There is nothing more we can do now at this point to hasten their disappearance. Let the sun shine. This is Bruce Robertson. You wouldn't go out on a winter day without a coat. And could you imagine camping out on a snowy field without a tent or a sleeping bag? Just lying there? Of course not. Well, what about your flowers? Don't they deserve the same? Larry Somke says, you bet.
Hey, Larry, how you doing? Bruce, hey, what's going on?
Ever the gardener, here it is, yeah. A little bit of snow on the ground, and you're still out. Well, what are you doing?
Well, I'm putting my garden to bed for the winter. This is my perennial garden, and I've actually worked on this a lot over the last couple of years, and I want to protect it and get it ready to grow again next spring after all the cold weather is done.
So what's involved in putting your bed, your flower bed to bed for the winter?
Well, you want to prune the perennials down right to the ground level, and that's what I was doing when you walked up. I just snipped them right off. This used to be about a 3 foot high plant. I've just snipped it right down to the ground level, and so that you've cleared all that air, all that debris away, and then you get all that debris out of the garden. Next thing you do is that you put a blanket on it. But you want to make sure that you don't start this process of clearing out your perennial bed for the winter until it really gets cold.
Why is that?
Well, if you start pruning it earlier in the fall, say in October or September, there's still going to be some warm days. And if you prune it, whenever you prune it, it encourages new growth. So you want to wait till the plant is starting to go into its dormancy period and then prune it back, because if you prune it too soon, new growth will come up and then the plant can be damaged.
Be subjected to frost and the snow.
So our ground is definitely frozen here.
Definitely,
now.
Yes. So you talk about a blanket.
Right.
What are you using here?
Well, we're trying to protect the plants from the freezing and thawing and heaving of the ground that goes on during the winter in most of the colder parts of this area. And if the ground thaws out in the dead of the winter and then freezes again, it can heave the plants up. The perennials themselves can come up out of the ground, and they can be damaged by the resumption of the cold. So what you want to do is put a thermal blanket on there. Snow would be the very best. That's unreliable, though. So some of the things that I like to use...
Meaning that sometimes it would thaw and...
And you don't know if you're going to get a solid snow cover anymore. And so some of the things I like to use are straw, just good old bedding straw. And straw is better than hay because straw has no weeds. You'll not be introducing new weeds into the garden. And then another great use for recycling your Christmas tree is after Christmas this year, when you take the tree down, it's still going to be nice and green and bushy and leafy. So just snip the leaves off. Here, let me do one of those for you. Here. Just snip the branches off from the Christmas tree and then just put those down on top of the plants. I've got some Jupiter's beard here and some lavender that I'm trying to cover up, and I've got some other biennials and some other little herbs in here that I'm going to cover up for the winter. And so Christmas tree boughs are good, straw is good, snow is good. There's always the big controversy about leaves.
Yeah, what about leaves?
Leaves, big leaves like maple leaves, you wouldn't want to just put those down whole on the garden. They can mat down, they can smother the plants, they can choke the plants. Leaves are also considered to be a breeding ground for diseases, which they can be. I've been very successful using a lot of leaves where in my garden I have a very environmental soil, very enriched, lots of microorganisms. So if you're having problems with diseases in your garden, you may not want to use leaves. But if you do use leaves, make sure you shred them. Run them through the lawnmower, something, before you put them down. You say, I have some shredded leaves over there. I have compost here. I have straw here. I put down a variety of things on the garden and then wish them well for the winter.
So putting your flower bed to bed for the winter is pretty much the last thing you do before you go inside and light the fire.
That's right. And make sure you wait till the ground is good and cold. And then you'll be doing your perennials a good favor.
Okay, Larry. Well, we'll see you next time doing something somewhere. But probably from now on, there'll be less and less outside.
There'll be less outside, but there's still some outside stuff I'll be on.
We'll see you next time, then.
Come by anytime.
Bye-bye. Larry Somke, the environmental gardener, author of Beautiful Easy Gardens. His sleepy flower beds surround his home in Hollowville, New York. This is Bruce Robertson. Continuing to revamp federal policy toward resource management, President Clinton has named Jack Ward Thomas to head up the U.S. Forest Service. Thomas, 59, comes to the post from a Forest Service lab in Oregon, where he is generally credited with having raised concerns about the northern spotted owl and its dwindling habitat. In taking over the top spot, the top perch, you might say, Thomas knows he faces both critics and bureaucracy, but he remains undaunted.
I've been working for the Forest Service for 27 years, so becoming the chief, I'm still within the agency that I've worked with for 27 years. Somebody asked me the other day, "Are you afraid? Are you scared?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Are you nervous?" And I said, "No." And they said, "How could you possibly not be nervous or scared?" And I said, "Well, One is that I've got 30,000 people that work for me that know exactly what they're doing. That gives me some level of constant confidence, and I'm going to do just like I did every job I've ever had in my life. I'm going to work as hard as I possibly can, and that will either be good enough or it won't.
In assessing his role and level of responsibility, both in the big leather chair in Washington, Thomas takes a characteristically pragmatic view.
I've been a research scientist, and as I've said all along, in most of our work, we propose, and it's fully understood that somebody else will dispose. Then when you get to the choice of making the decisions, I think it's well to understand that your ability to operate in that arena is not unlimited. You're bounded by law, you're bounded by budget, you're bounded by circumstances. The chief of the Forest Service probably can't make more than 5% difference one way or the other, but I think it can be a rather significant 5%.
As Thomas takes over, he does so at a time when the Forest Service is seen by many as no friend of the environment, with its policies of managing the nation's forests for purposes of timber cutting, threatening if not destroying wildlife habitat in the process. With the appointment of Thomas to head up the service, the Clinton administration is sending a signal that it is out to change this negative image. In fact, the administration launched this campaign for change at the Forest Conference in Portland last spring. During that meeting, the president heard testimony from all sides of the conflicting issues in the Pacific Northwest. Then, early last summer, Mr. Clinton issued a policy of reform toward managing the region, both for its jobs and for environmental protection. Thomas sees himself as tough and holding the line under the new policies. Not concerned to veil his comments, though, he says the failure in the past has not been within the Forest Service itself, but with administrations of past presidents who have tied the Forest Service hands through budgetary and other means.
I think first you have to realize that the one is that I guess my motto all my life has been and will be one I'd carry through as chief is tell the truth and obey the law. Now there's a lot of leeway beyond that. Basically, any chief of the Forest Service carries out the will of the administration under which they serve, provided it's within the bounds of regulation and law. Secondly, you are directed on a year-to-year basis by the budget passed by the Congress of the United States as to what you will try to achieve within that year. It's not within the bounds of the chief of the Forest Service or any Forest Service administrator to say, I don't like the way that money was appropriated. I will do what I please rather than what the Congress says. That's not going to happen. That's anarchy, and besides, you go to jail for doing things like that.
Yet the post does carry with it certain powers and mandates, ones he is likely to need, whether or not he likes it. These pressures will come from advocates on both sides of any given issue, whether it is over the Pacific Northwest or the great northern forests of New England, areas where environmental protection and economic stability often have not been compatible. Out of the conference last spring emerged a new idea, new at least to politics, ecosystem management. Thomas has been instrumental in crafting this policy, whereby a region is viewed as an integrated system. Now he is eager to get underway.
The president looked at 10 options put forward to him for ecosystem management, chose one. They received 100,000 comments on that decision, and the environmental impact assessment team is now in the process of evaluating all those, and there may be some modifications in the option that the president chose, but very obviously we're well down the road to beginning to deal with that. The next aspect of it is, and the more challenging one is how are we going to consider public lands within the context that they exist? That is, they're buried within private lands, and how species. Ecosystems know man-made boundaries. As a result, how do we derive an approach in a cooperative fashion to be able to get a broader view of land management that runs beyond land ownerships?
As he says, he is concerned to know and obey the law. Actually, the collection of laws, the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Wilderness Act, the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act, and the Resources Planning Act, to cite just a few. The challenge, says Thomas, is to weave all of these together.
One of the confusing things that we've had to work our way through, and still are in the process of doing, is how do we come into obedience with all of those laws and the regulations issued pursuant to those laws, and how do we do that simultaneously? That's a tall order, and we're struggling to meet that. The other aspect of it is that the president has made it very clear that the federal agency should come more into a cooperative role, one government, if you will, as opposed to having a number of federal agencies working what has appeared sometimes in the past to be at cross purposes. And I think the operation in the Pacific Northwest, or the pilot on how we deal with those questions in terms of obedience to all of those laws and all of those mandates under a concept of one government.
And just how, in command of the Forest Service, will he keep from rolling off the log and falling to either those who advocate increased environmental protection or those who would broaden the wood products industrial base?
My temptation is to say very carefully, but I think you have your finger on the situation. I think if one examines these sorts of things, debates over nearly anything historically, the extremes in the argument merely define the outer boundaries. Ultimately, one comes to some resolution in between those extremes.
As he approaches the new job, Thomas says he, as we and the rest of the nation, would do best to heed some sage advice.
Essentially, as Aldo Leopold said, the first rule of intelligent tinkering is to save every cog and wheel, doing the best we can to preserve those cogs and wheels and the integrity of the system. I think the best that we can do is preserve those options and those productive systems for future generations. How they will deal with it will be their problem or their prerogative. On the other hand, if we do not pass on to them functional systems in good shape that can be sustained for century after century, essentially, then we have not done our job.
Finally, one of the hardest lessons he says he has learned is that change is about the only thing we can count on. And realizing this, as we have begun to do as a nation, has had a serious effect on national policies.
For example, we certainly are now viewing the national forest differently than we did with full consensus, almost full consensus of the Congress 20 years ago. Things change. One of the things that seems to be going is a sense of stability, in the sense that things can change very dramatically, and not just in terms of scientific knowledge, in terms of budgets, in terms of public will, acceptability, law, insect and disease outbreaks. The world is not a particularly stable place, and perhaps in the past we dreamed as foresters, as forest managers, that on the larger sense, we could produce that stability, and we found that our ability to do that is not as pronounced as we had thought.
Jack Ward Thomas, the new head of the U.S. Forest Service, speaking to us from his outpost in Oregon on the eve of his move to Washington. As with any bureaucracy, the Forest Service will not likely see immediate and identifiable changes the result of his arrival. But it is at least in keeping with the new approach to environmental protection that the head of the service is a scientist first, administrator second. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on the Environment Show for this week. Thanks much for joining us. Make a note, tune in next week at this same time for another edition. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, program number 205. That's 1-800-767-1929, The Environment Show, number 205. Well, coming soon, what's new in the home building industry? New proposals for Western grazing and Paul Winter, musical environmentalist. That's coming soon on The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. We had help this week from Tracy O'Connell. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the national Bible of the old car hobby, monthly from Bennington, Vermont, 1-800-CARHERE.